apart from the troops yesterday.
A soldier was an officer. God's alive. No wonder Manas put out a report for him.
I coarsen my voice so he will not recognize it.
No, sir.
His horse paws at the sand, digging trenches that I feel in my chest. Soldiers continue to advance past, many slowing to get around us.
I could use another man to replace the missing officer, Manas says. I admire your dedication, Chit. I'm promoting you to captain. Come with me.
I mangle a guffaw, cramming it inside me. Manas is promoting me to captain. I was his captain and commander. For him to advance me, or in all actuality demote me, scalds. Regardless of his arrogance, at any moment he will discover who I am. Natesha and Yatin need time to vanish into the troops.
No, thank you, sir.
I lift my chin. Our gazes meet, and Manas's eyes fly wide open. He leans down and pulls off my headscarf. While he bends over me, I drop my water cup and slug him in the nose. He swings away, cradling his injury. His fingers come away bloody. Manas crushes my headscarf in his fist.
Seize him!
Soldiers rush in around me. I do not struggle as they apprehend my sword, wrench my arms behind my back, and bind my wrists. Natesha and Yatin are gone. Run, and don't look back.
Commander!
Manas snipes, grasping his talwar.
This is Captain Devon Naik, a conspirator for Prince Ashwin and kindred Kalinda. This man is a traitor!
The commander falls all over his words.
He said he was from the south. He was wearing a uniform.
Enough!
Manas rides to his side, both astride their horses.
Did he have any companions?
Two men, one large and one small.
Is that all?
Yes, General.
Good.
Manas draws his talwar and plunges the curved blade into the commander's belly. His whole body twitches, blood blooming around the wound. Manas wrenches out his weapon, and the commander keels over, plummeting off his horse to the sand. Manas sheathes his talwar and points to the closest unit of soldiers.
Find Captain Naik's accomplices!
They obey in haste. Manas leans over me, his head impeding the sun.
I should have known you were skulking around when we caught the Gaylor boy. That filthy vermin begged for his worthless life.
Rowan did no such thing, but I bottle a retort. Manas will not bait me. Soldiers haul Yatin over to us. Also robbed of his headscarf, my friend walks with his shoulders back. His size must have given him away. Or maybe not. I interpret his stubborn, set jaw. Yatin was caught intentionally. He let the soldiers find him to give Natesha more time to escape.
Where's the third man?
Manas demands.
No sign of him, sir,
answers a soldier. I do not miss Yatin's fleeting smile.
Keep looking!
The men dash off to search, but Natesha is clever, and with the extra time Yatin's capture provided her, she will not be found. Manas smirks down at me.
You should have killed me when you had the chance, Devon.
I close my mouth, unwilling to grant him the satisfaction of agreeing.
Bring them!
The soldiers tether our bindings to the commander's horse and shove Yatin and me after their general. We slog up and down sand dunes, grime blowing in our eyes and mouths. I stumble to my knees, and the horse drags me until I find my footing again. Ahead, far past the furthermost soldier and wagon, a haze distorts the sweltering horizon. The smoggy film marks the beginning of a mirage, the gods' presumed doorway to paradise. But not even the illusion of a fictional haven can close the pit in my stomach. As we near the front of the troops, the air holds a leaden tang that bleeds on my tongue. The heaviness accompanies or originates from Udug. I can feel him near. His presence sticks to me like cobwebs, snagging on everything and itching my skin. We gain on a large unit of soldiers hoisting an elaborate litter. The draperies are closed, sealing its rider in the dark. But pungent bitterness pours from it, tangible as smoke. Manas calls for a covered wagon to halt and opens the rear door. Opal shelters her eyes from the sunlight. Dried blood covers her bound wrists. Manas could have restrained her with snake root or fed her neutralizing tonic to dim her powers, but cutting her is crueler. Her shoulder is wrapped with a bandage, and burn marks the size of fingerprints dot her arms. Yatin and I are impelled inside with her. Manas slams the door and casts us into darkness.
Opal, are you all right? I ask.
Tell me I'm wrong, she whispers. Tell me it isn't true.
My eyes adapt to the dimness and distinguish her slight shape. She is shorter than Kali, but nearly as thin.
I'm sorry, I say.
A whimper ruptures from her lips. The wagon starts to rock, bouncing us around.
We came looking for you and Brock.
We were separated when the wing flyer crashed. I haven't seen him since.
This should be good news.
Brock was probably never with the army. Rowan never heard him nearby, and we did not discover a second prison wagon.
Then where is he?
I almost got away,
Opal sniffles.
But the demon Raja struck me with his blue fire.
That explains the bandage on her shoulder.
Manas recognized me and put me in here with the other Buddha captives. The demon Raja, he fed off the other soul fire. I'm the only one left.
Yatin shifts uneasily. We are both grateful Opal survived. But why her? The demon Raja told Rowan you'd been of use to him. I start, selecting my words carefully.
He invites me to supper every night and asks me questions.
What about?
Yatin inquires.
He asked me about Vani. I didn't know the answers, so he burned me. I made things up. But when I couldn't tell him about the rebels, his frustration grew.
Tears clog Opal's voice.
I would have said anything to save Rowan.
Yatin slides closer to her, and she rests against him, crying. Thank Anu that Natesha got away. We have a friend outside the wagon who knows we are here. But Udug is out there too. And he has no incentive to let mortals such as Yatin and me live. Little quills of goose flesh bristle up my arms. He feeds off Buddha's soul fire. Udug is growing more powerful. Try as I might, I cannot strategize our next move. When battling an opponent bigger or stronger than I am, I was trained to go for his feet, knock him down, and disarm him. Udug set his footing on unstable ground, his borrowed identity, but no one will believe me over him. Even if I could knock him off his imposter throne, I cannot disarm him of his powers. Never have I fought an enemy more entrenched in the dark. The wagon rocks headlong across the desert, bringing us closer to Vani, closer to the start of the war.
21. Kalinda. The airship's hull provides ample room for all the sisters and wards. Ashwin, Inda, and Pons stay on deck, while I help the little ones descend the ladder to below. Straw carpets the floor, and several yaks penned in the corner account for the stench of manure. I overhear a crewman say the airship was en route to deliver the herd to the clan in the Arctic tundra, but switched course when they received Tinley's urgent message about the fire. We rest on bales of grass and escape the freezing temperature huddled beneath wool blankets the crew passes out. I try to repress my shivering, but the blanket merely insulates my cold. The wards, however, are resilient. One of them begins a game of fly-flight crane, and soon a group of them are darting between the bales with their arms spread like wings. The sisters let them play, the semblance of normality welcome. After some time, Priestess Mita wanders down the ladder, each of her steps more unenthusiastic than the last. Even after the Paljorians pass out dried apricots, she maintains her scowl. Sarita shares the bale beside mine with two girls, all chewing fruit. Their soul fires glow dimly. Need flares at the back of my throat. I could take a little, just enough to muffle the cold screaming inside me. If they could feel my deadening heart, they would offer up their light. I slide my hand under the blanket, reaching for the closest girl's arm. Hungry? Sarita holds out the dried fruit for me. No, thank you. I jam my quaking fingers between my thighs. I nearly stole soul fire to stoke my own. This is wrong, yet the craving burns so strongly my eyes sting. I curl into myself. It's so cold. Sarita rests her hand on my arm. Kalinda, are you all right? Parch her. Take her light. I twitch away and rise. I cannot stand the priestess's ingratitude any longer. The partial truth. Priestess Mita has not given thanks to our hosts, but her disrespect is also an excuse to leave. Shedding the blanket, I climb the ladder to the open deck. The tidy area is stained mahogany and coated with a glossy veneer, and rigging and rope ladders are strung all over. Chilly air encases me like a snowy tomb. I hug myself to find my elusive inner warmth. Tinley crosses the deck to me. There you are. My father and Prince Ashwin are waiting for you. She drapes a bearskin over my shoulders and directs me to the chief's private quarters. I draw the pelt closer. Are you coming in? I need to see my falcon, Char. Tinley points at the Mahati she left near the woods. Her prior falcon, Bia, died during our trial tournament. Tinley was devastated. Mahati falcons imprint on their handlers as hatchlings. The pair became more than master and bird. They were best friends. How did you find and train Char so quickly? A trader was selling her for her feathers. She fell into a depression after her handler died. She wouldn't let me ride her at first. Now all she wants to do is soar. Char squawks at the airship. She's hungry. Tinley opens her satchel to show me a dead hare, and then disembarks. I watch her feed Char and scratch her feathery breast. I wonder if Char learned to trust Tinley because she sensed she was broken-hearted too. After a brief knock on the chief's door, I enter. Lanterns brighten the modest cabin. Animal teeth of all sizes are strung across the wall behind the chief's desk where he and Ashwin are seated. Inda and Pons sit off to the side.
Kalinda, says the chief, please join us. Prince Ashwin was explaining your circumstances.
I occupy a chair near Inda and Pons, and Ashwin resumes.
After the demon Raja fulfills my wish, I believe he intends to assist Kor in avenging Anu for usurping the mortal realm from the primeval gods. My study of the Samia Temple's texts reinforced the grudge between Kor and Anu. I'm even more convinced the demon Raja plans to release his master. The only way to vanquish him is to cast him through the gate to the void, but nothing I read has cited where the gate is located.
Chief Naresh lays his hands over his broad chest.
We don't know where it is either. Only demons or fallen souls can find the gate.
I know of a way. I say, we have failed to unite with the rebels, but we can still accomplish one task before we leave the mountains. Raja Tarak visited me. He said my thoughts summoned him from the void. My gaze bounces from Inda to Pons and then to the chief. They stare at me in confusion. Ashwin pales.
You saw him again?
On our first night at the temple. He came to me in the North Tower.
He's done this before, Inda asks.
I understand it sounds odd, but I'm not imagining it.
We believe you, she replies, and Pons nods. Our people have tales of souls traveling by shadows.
As do ours, the chief adds.
Tarek knows where the gate is, I say. He said he would show me. In return, he asked that I stand before the gate and speak his name.
Ashwin pushes to his feet.
No. You summoned Tarek just by thinking of him. Consider what power it would give him if you spoke his name at the gate.
The prince is right, says Chief Naresh.
Names hold power.
But what if this is the only way? I ask. Chief Naresh exhales, building a long pause.
The mortal realm is closely intertwined with the beyond and the void. We cannot tamper with that balance.
Ashwin paces in front of the desk.
We cannot bargain with Tarek. We'll find another way to find the gate.
He anticipates my protest and raises a palm.
Don't think of him, Kalinda. Don't invoke the Evernight. We'll turn to the light for help.
Like we turned to the rebels, I rejoin. Ashwin stops pacing and looks up, dodging our gazes.
That was my fault. I shouldn't have trusted Hostin.
His admission drops a pause over us. I am just as to blame as he is. Wish I could take back the cruel things I said to him this morning. Chief Naresh breaches the silence.
Prince Ashwin told me the warlord thinks ending him will also end Udug.
I believe the opposite, Inda says, quiet but definitive.
Ashwin should have died from Anjali's winnowing, but he healed rapidly. Not even bruises remain. I can only presume that Ashwin's heart's wish ties him to Udug in other unseen ways.
My mind races to reach her logic. You think Udug's immortality extends to Ashwin so long as he is bound by his heart's wish?
Yes.
Inda knows nothing of my strife with Ashwin, but could her theory also extend to me? Ashwin's bargain with Udug may explain why the icy poisons have not consumed me. The heart's wish of the prince could be prolonging my life.
Our Galers are storing up strength for the flight back to Paljor, says the chief.
Inda whitens at the mention of the airship flying.
We'll provide temporary refuge to you, as well as the sisters and temple wards.
Thank you, but I cannot go. I smile to ease my refusal. I'm needed in Vani.
You'll never make it in time to join the navy, says Pons.
I will if Tinley flies me on her falcon.
My daughter isn't going near the war front,
Chief Naresh answers.
We understand, Ashwin replies.
I arch a brow at his use of we. He intends to come with me?
She can take us as far as you're comfortable.
I add one last entreaty. Please, Chief Naresh, we have to help our people. He sits up from his reclined position.
I'll permit this out of respect for your parents, Kalinda. Let's speak with Tinley.
He and Ashwin rise to find his daughter. I'll be there in a moment, I say, staying with Inda and Pons. Will you two be all right going to Paljor?
We'll be fine.
Pons rests his big hand over Inda's small belly. They must be glad to miss the war front. Inda pats Pons's knee.
Would you leave us a moment, please?
He kisses her cheek and goes. I presume Inda wants to speak about her father or her pregnancy, but she focuses her serious gaze on me.
I'm concerned about you, Kalinda.
I saw what you did to Prince Ashwin last night. Parching may seem like a reasonable remedy for your pain, but too much parching is dangerous.
I bristle in defense. People are not afraid of burners merely because they fear fire. They fear the violation of someone parching their soul. I only borrowed Ashwin's soul fire because I was trying to stop the wildfire from spreading.
You didn't borrow anything. You robbed it. Parched soul fire cannot be returned.
I snap my mouth shut. The opposite of parching is scorching, wherein a burner pushes their power into another and scorches them to ash. So, no, I cannot return the soul fire I take.
Parching too often is addictive. You could become dependent on other soul fire to replenish your powers. Inda places her hand on mine. What are demons most known for?
Frightening people.
They frighten us because they thrive off destroying all that shines. Demons spite the stars, curse the moon, and abhor the sun. I know Udug's cold fire is still within you, but the cost is too great for you to give in. You'll sacrifice your inner radiance for a moment in the sun, then it will fade, leaving you parched for light.
I tell Inda what I dare not admit to Ashwin.
I don't know if we can defeat him.
You can. Fight him, Kalinda. Hold on to your inner star and don't let go.
Inda seals her encouragement with a kiss on my cheek. Being with child has opened her to all sorts of affection.
I'll go see where Pawn's got to.
She leaves the chief's quarters, but her caution acerbates my worries. Will Udug's cold fire forever change me? I know of only one way to find out. I exhale and close my eyes. A tiny light glows in my mind. My inner star's color has changed from a clear light to brilliant sapphire. The longer I search for purity in the blue light, the icier I feel. The star grows razor-sharp points that spike into my skull. Behind my eyes, it burns like frostbite. I open them and tears pour out. The stinging inside my head stays, a rising pressure of cold. Inda and Pons come back in to find me doubled over and clutching my head.
Kalinda, what happened? Inda asks, hurrying to my side.
I wait for the flash of cold to thaw, but the icicles impale deeper. She presses her warm palm to my forehead.
You're freezing.
Her warmth is like a cool drink in the desert. I react as a starving soul and draw in her heat. Her soul fire flows into me, trickling down my body. Inda gasps, locked against me, as I parch more and more. Pons wrenches her away. She teeters and passes out. He catches her limp body and jostles her. Inda does not wake. His terror-filled gaze darts to me. I have devoured Inda's soul fire, chewed it up, and swallowed it down. Backing away, I have no words, no justification. I flee the chief's quarters and run down the plank. A brisk wind slaps my cheeks, but I am warm, so wonderfully warm and bright. Demons steal the light. Is that what I am becoming? Udug's cold powers are strangling the mortal and Buddha sides of me. Without them, just one part of my heritage will be left. The ancestry line that traces back to the fire god's natural father, the demon Kor. Clutching the bearskin at my throat, I slow near the Mahati falcon. Tinley and her father ready the great bird for our journey. While they pass heated words back and forth, Ashwin waits a respectful distance away. He also wears a bearskin for our flight. After a reticent glance at me, he explains,
Tinley wants to stay in Vani and fight, but her father forbids it.
I'm sorry I was angry with you. It was unfair of me. His attention jumps to me.
I'm sorry my heart's wish hurt you. I wasn't aware I had... that it tied us together.
Behind the squabbling father and daughter, strings of smoke rise from the temple wreckage. Standing before the ruins of my home, my own heart's wish comes to mind with painful clarity. For years, my dream was to live here, in peace with Jaya.
And now?
I still wish for peace. I bury my chin in the bearskin, imagining Inda's disappointment in me when she wakes. Though I could try to rationalize my actions, I endangered her and her unborn child. I stole her peace of mind and possibly ruined her trust. Chief Naresh's voice breaks through my thoughts.
I'd like you to come home when you return from Vani, Tinley. Your mother and I miss you.
I cannot, she says in a frustrated growl. Char didn't hatch from one of our nests. The flock will view her as an intruder. She's so small she could get hurt. Ashwin and I size up the falcon. Bia was massive, but Char is still large. How big do Mahati falcons grow? Chief Naresh briefly closes his eyes, seeking restraint, and strides to us.
Tinley will take you now. Kindred, it's been a joy.
He envelops me in a hug. Devon holds me like this, until my heart may burst from his goodness.
The gods will watch over you. Go on your way now. You're losing daylight.
The chief hands his bearskin cape to his daughter. She accepts it, kisses him hastily on the cheek, and leaps astride her great bird. Ashwin helps me up and hoists himself behind me. The hems of my trousers ride up, and the bird's sleek feathers skim against my ankles. Char extends her swooping wings and leaps into the air. Tinley summons an elevating gust, and I momentarily lose my breath. The abrupt climb is like taking off in a wing flyer. From above, the temple rubble is more visible. Is this what Anu sees when he looks down upon us? Did he see the fire was an accident? Wolf's Peak juts into the slate sky. I comb its cliffs and impenetrable vertexes for Ikor, desperate for a glimpse of the god's mountain home. Show me, Anu. Show me you forgive me. But Char banks south, putting the pinnacle of the mountain behind us.
22. Devon. Soon after the wagon stops for the night, Manas returns.
Get out, Devon. The Raja has asked for you.
I am hardly surprised. Opal dissatisfied Udug with her lack of knowledge about Vani. Who better to inquire of the palace and rebels than the former captain of the guard? Opal starts to get out too, but Manas throws out his arm.
Stay here, filth! The Raja has finished suffering your repulsive presence.
Yet he surrounds himself with you, I say, climbing out of the wagon. Manas smacks the back of my head. I stumble forward to my knees, my hands still tethered behind me. As I rise, the scene beyond camp emerges. Turquoise palace shines upon the hill, and Vani stretches out below it. To those who love Vani, it is known as the City of Gems, a sparkling oasis for all. But the mines beneath the palace that once harvested rich veins of turquoise were boarded up long ago. Like those dried-up veins, Vani's shutters are closed and dim. Men rush around us, situating the catapults and unloading the ammunition. Preparations have begun for the army to break through the city wall. Manas shuts the wagon door and nudges me across the sand toward Udug's tent.
Who did you bring with you, Devon? The commander saw a third man.
I don't know what you mean. Manas pushes me, nearly tripping me again. I already have sand in places I would rather not think about.
The missing soldier was your fault, wasn't it?
He asks. You're missing a soldier? Another push.
Raja Tarek will end your life.
The night thickens as we approach the tent. I told you in Eresh, he isn't Raja Tarek.
Quit your lies!
Manas cuts my bindings free and shoves me inside, but does not follow. Lamplight glows upon the lavish gold, purple, and red carpets laid out on the floor. An unnatural coldness dulls the air. A table full of rich dishes of food wafts of decadence. My mouth waters at the spicy scents. Silk cushions are set around the table, and Udug occupies the head.
You know who I am, he says, tearing off a chunk of flatbread.
I rub my wrists, bruised from my bindings.
You're the voider.
He smirks as he chews.
My master calls me Udug.
Your master is the demon Kur? He bites off more bread.
I know him as Kur, god of the Evernight.
Kur's name with the descriptor god rankles. The Parajana faith teaches that Kur, the first ever dragon, was created by a primeval goddess to combat her son, Anu. But Anu prevailed and usurped his mother. Kur, belonging neither to the skies nor the land, claimed the Evernight as home for himself and his depraved followers. Uduk speaks with his mouth full.
I have missed this ritual of eating. You mortals, especially your rulers, bask in self-indulgence.
He smacks his lips. A bread knife rests near the center of the table. If I lunge, I may reach it before he does.
Why are you here, Captain? Why aren't you with the Kindred? Has the Prince claimed her?
Kali cannot be claimed, I say shortly. Tarek is proof of that.
Tarek is guilty of selfishness and conceit, but never overreach. He took what he lusted after, claimed what he desired, and ruled what he could seize. He was never complacent.
Uduk says the last as though accusing me of such.
You're here because you're not that sort of man.
Again, phrased as an insult.
Prince Ashwin, however, has the potential to rival his father. I saw his heart's wish. He lusts after it all, the Empire, the Imperial Army, the Kindred. His desire to rule with Kalinda is why I have not taken her life.
My joints lock down. But you wounded her.
Not wounded. Restored. Within her burner soul is great potential. I provided her a push toward a better state. Alas, you are utterly forgettable.
His conversational tone contrasts his pitying expression.
Dutiful men are all the same. Martyrs. You want for everything but take nothing for yourself. You sacrifice your own happiness for others and validate your ensuing misery with your magnanimous loyalty.
I lick my lips. My mouth dry and sticky. I deserted the army.
By word, perhaps, but not by deed. You blended in with my troops without difficulty. You tricked a commander and went so far as to risk revealing your identity to stop a catapult from landing on a group of comrades. You will always be a soldier.
His statement reverberates too deeply. My godly duty is to serve the Raja, and whenever I go against my purpose, awful consequences follow.
You hide behind the will of someone stronger than you, and call it honor, says Uduk.
I must point out the irony. You're hiding behind Tarek. Uduk concedes with a twitch of his head.
Tarek's physical form is required for my bargain with the prince. When I am free, I will reveal my true self.
He drinks his entire glass of wine, gluttonous in his feasting. I anticipate he will inquire about the city's fortifications or how best to infiltrate the palace. But he asks me nothing. I shuffle closer to Uduk and the bread knife. What part do I play in your scheme?
Mankind has no part, he says, refilling the wine chalice. You will all disappear when the Evernight devours the lights in the sky.
And the Buddhas? A blue flame flashes in Uduk's pupils.
Only burners will be offered the choice to serve Kor or perish. His ancestry flows through them. They were born of fire and venom.
A breath of his foul cold skulks over me. Opal thinks Brock got away from the army, but what if he didn't? My brother is a burner. He's missing. Uduk's lips pull upward patronizingly, an exact replica of Tarek's condescending expression.
Is that why you've come? To find your brother? This is tragic. You came all this way, got that boy Galer killed, and yet your brother isn't here.
I lunge for the knife, My fingers brush the handle when a blue flame hits the plate. Cold bites into my hand. I rear back, clenching my teeth down on a howl. My struck fingertips turn white like hoarfrost. I puff out quick breaths to drive away the pain. Udug pings the wine bottle against his chalice, a summons, and Manas appears.
I'm finished.
Yes, your majesty. Manas jerks me from the tent.
I clutch my injured hand. Why are they keeping us prisoner? The army holds captives for few purposes. To await execution, exploit them for labor, or use them as ransom. None of those options are pleasant.
Manas, you have to listen to me. That isn't Tarek. His fist drives into my gut, and I bowl over. He grabs my hair and yanks my head back. You're alive because of Kalinda. When the Raja realizes you're worth nothing to her, I'll finish this.
You can hit me all you want. The truth is still the truth.
The truth is, you lost.
Manas grabs my tunic and hauls me to the wagon. The ammunition is nearly unloaded. Soldiers position the last of the catapults in a line facing the wall. The army is hours away from launching its attack, yet no torchlights flicker in the city watchtowers. Where are the rebels? Two soldiers guard the wagon. One unlocks the door, and Manas pushes me inside. I will have bruises from his handling, but they will hurt less than my frostbitten hand.
Time for your appointment with my dagger, filth.
Manas leans inside and reaches for Opal. He means to let her blood and weaken her powers. I slam my foot down on his hand, jamming it into the floor. He groans and tries to pull free, but I knee him in the jaw. The two guards draw their swords. One stabs at me. I twist away, grab his wrist with my unwound hand, and pull down. The man tumbles inside the wagon on top of Manas. Yatin whams his elbow into the side of his head. The soldier goes limp. The second guard attempts to run, but Yatin catches his neck with his bound hands and slams him into the door. Another guard is out. I pin Manas to the floor, digging my knee into his throat.
You'll suffer for treason,
he rasps.
Raja Tarek will drop you in a den of scorpions. You will feel the sting of 1,000...
Someone outside the wagon whacks Manas over the head with the hilt of a dagger. I twist to see a soldier with a headscarf draped over the lower half of his... no, her face. Natasha lifts the headscarf.
He was irritating me.
She cuts Opal's and Yatin's bindings. He scoops Natasha up and kisses her. She tugs fondly at his beard.
We have to go, right now.
An explosion goes off across camp. Fire and embers brighten the night. I climb out beside Natasha.
You've been busy, I remark.
Someone had to get us out of here.
She passes me her second dagger and notices my burns.
What happened?
It's nothing, let's go.
Opal slides out, and Yatin helps her stay upright. We follow Natasha through camp. Soldiers rush about, preoccupied with the fire. A catapult blazes in the distance.
Is that the catapult we pushed here? I ask.
I couldn't let our hard work go to waste.
Natasha glances over her shoulder at her handiwork.
A little bit of lamp oil, and look at it glow.
We skirt around a group of soldiers. I pick up a bucket, as though to gather water for the fire, and we leave camp. Opal starts to slow from her injuries, so Yatin carries her. I guide us across the sand dunes to the river Namu that runs through the city. I toss aside the bucket and hurry down the bank. Natasha and I wade into the river. The cool, shallow water mitigates my stinging burns. Opal hangs on to Yatin's neck, and we swim upstream. Guards on the outer wall regularly monitor the river for intruders, but no one calls for us to halt. We reach the culvert and pass through one at a time, fighting the current into Vani. I slog out of the water and on the other side of the city wall. A stone walking path rims the riverbank. Past it lies a courtyard, and beyond that, the roadways are cramped with huts. I detect no signs, noises, or smells of the living. Everyone has long fled the warlord.
Where to now? Yatin asks.
My sight drifts up to the palace. Whether the rebels are with us or against us depends on the outcome of Kali's meeting with Hastin. I still do not trust the warlord, but we have a better chance of allying with him than surviving another encounter with Udug. We'll use the old mine tunnels to sneak into the palace.
Do you think the rebels are on our side?
Natesha asks, squeezing water from her braid. We'll find out tomorrow. We'll need torches or lanterns to navigate the tunnels. Let's find somewhere close by to stay the night. We cross the pathway near the river and venture into the courtyard. Piles of stones litter the clearing. I pass a heap, and my belly clenches. Bits of scarlet from an imperial soldier's uniform are buried within. The rebels must have stoned the soldiers who were taken captive when they seized the palace. We hasten between the stoning piles, across the courtyard to the tightly packed rows of huts. The gods take pity on us. The first hut I investigate is vacant, except for the rats that flee when I open the door. I enter the one-room domicile and pick up an overturned chair. Sand covers the floor and furniture. I refill an oil lamp and light it. Natesha shades the windows with blankets to seal in the glow. Yatin ducks through the low door with Opal and lays her on a straw mattress. She rolls onto the sandy linens and shuts her eyes. While Yatin scrounges through the worn kitchen cupboards for food, Natesha brings a dry rag for my hand. She winds the cloth around my fingers and ties it tight. Yatin finds a couple of shriveled limes and cuts them up. The tangy smell carries to me, but I pass on my portion. Natesha and Yatin dine on the citrus, savoring the juice like it's honey. I prop the chair against the door and sit with Natesha's dagger in my lap. We should be safe here until morning, but I trust nothing in this hollow shell of the city I once knew. Leaning my head against the door jamb, I fall into old habits, listening for potential dangers. My desertion from the army did not fool anyone. Even Udug recognized my passion. I rely on the orderliness and discipline of the army. The only reason I would leave for good is for Kali. Yet every time I try to force our paths together and turn my back on my oath to serve the Empire, disaster befalls me and those I care about. I wish I could say what that means for us. But all I know is that I am needed here to defend what is left of my home.
23. Kalinda. We fly into the night, the Mahati Falcon undaunted by the dark. Glittering stars chase us, so close they promise the warmth of a thousand wishes, but mock me with their unreachable light. The soul fire I parched from Inda has long since receded, and, as she cautioned me, I am colder than before. My jaw aches from clamping my chattering teeth. Ashwin holds on to me, a rock against my tide of shivers. I thirst for soul fire. The temptation to parch him or Tinley presses into my chest. If I move my hand to Tinley's arm... No. Remember Inda. I will not violate another friend's trust. Midway through the night, I drift off into delirium. When I wake later, night still stretches to infinity, and my shivers have stopped. I am not cold, nor am I warm. I feel nothing. Even the ache in my knee has gone. Freedom from pain would be a gift, but the sudden emptiness unsettles me. My heart beats slow, a sluggish thump. I shut my eyes and search for the star in my private night. My soul fire is so tiny, shrunken to a sapphire pinpoint, I nearly miss it. Dreading what I will find, I hold one hand between Tinley and myself and call upon my abilities. My fingers glow blue. I wait for a shiver, but none arrives. I let the light fade. Udug's powers have usurped my own, yet my soul fire must still be there, buried far down inside me, or I would have perished. Or the prince's heart's wish is the only thing left keeping me alive.
I seek out the crescent moon, its silver illumination my only protection against the persistent night. I expect tears to come, to rise from a well of panic, but they too are frozen within me. Gods preserve me through the night. I repeat the plea until the sky lightens to dusky blue hues, and I utter a myriad of thanks. The sunrise reveals grassy fields and a winding river. Char is quick, even quicker than Tinley implied. We soar up the valley, trailing the river Namu. Up ahead, a long line of vessels sail the waterway. My outlook brightens. We have found the Lestarian navy. Devon and the others should be with them. Ashwin yells for Tinley to pursue the vessels. She directs the falcon lower. Char's reflection zips over the river like a stream of fire. As we soar nearer to the last boat, a conch shell sounds. The sailors dash to their water cannons. They don't know who we are. Tinley guides the Mahati higher while Ashwin and I wave. Admiral Rimba stands atop the lookout platform on the lead vessel. He recognizes us and signals his crews to stand down. Seeing Inda's father presses more guilt upon me. My hunger for soul fire has passed, dulled by the numbness. But not my memory of what I did. Char lands along the riverbank. Tinley jumps down and the falcon hunts for hares in the grass. I slide off and brace against the bird on rickety legs. Ashwin dismounts and rubs his sore thighs. He leaves his bearskin on to fend off the cool of the morning. The brisk dawn does not bother my already frigid fingers and toes. The navy moors along the riverbank. Admiral Rimba comes ashore in his all-white uniform, Princess Jemmy with him. She studies the large Mahati falcon and her wild-looking rider with keen interest. I scan the boat decks. Where's Devon?
His party wasn't at the meet point,
Admiral Rimba replies, a lump of mint stuffed in his cheek. A weight hammers down on me. Devon does not break his word. His search for Brock must have gone awry. Then why not send Natesha or Yatin? Admiral Rimba chews the wad of mint in his mouth faster.
Where's Inda? She and Pons have gone to Paljor,
Ashwin replies.
Paljor?
The Admiral demands. Tinley stiffens but keeps her back turned to us, giving her attention to her falcon. They're safe, I say, the last word sticking in my throat. I hope Inda is all right, but what if I hurt her more than I thought?
Pons will look after Inda,
Ashwin says. He is so impatient to explain what happened, he misses the Admiral's granite stare.
Our meeting with the Warlord was a farce. Hostin sent rebels to attack us, and the Samia Temple was destroyed. Chief Naresh saw the smoke and came to investigate. His daughter Tinley graciously agreed to fly us here. Inda and Pons have gone to Paljor to await word from Datu Bulan. The rebels are still against us,
Admiral Rimba summarizes.
But you're unhurt?
He has graciously extended his concern for his daughter to us, but I do not deserve his kindness.
We are,
Ashwin replies, then answers more of the Admiral's questions. As he recounts our battle against Anjali and Indira, Princess Jemmy interrupts him.
You stood up to Buddhas?
I defended myself and Kalinda,
Ashwin answers modestly. Princess Jemmy considers him anew, raking her gaze over him. He clears his throat and resumes speaking to the Admiral.
Any word about the Imperial Army? Last we heard they were nearing the desert. That was yesterday.
I am pinned to my spot by panic. The army is ahead of schedule. They may already have reached Vani.
We'll arrive tomorrow,
the Admiral says.
You may come with us, but I suggest you continue to travel by sky. The Sea Raiders are following a few leagues behind us.
Ashwin and I peer downriver, but see no trace of Captain Locke or his vessel.
They thought you were aboard one of our ships. We've maintained a wall of silence to deflect their listening galers, but they won't have missed the Mahati Falcon. They'll figure out you were never with us.
What will they do? I ask.
They have no means of flying, so they'll probably continue to pursue us. Captain Locke isn't one who gives up easily.
Princess Jemmy ventures up to the Mahati and strokes her vibrant feathers.
Char peers at the princess and tolerates her touch. Eluding the Sea Raiders is motive enough to fly, but Char will also be faster than the Navy. After a nod from Ashwin, I answer, "We'll go with Tinley and meet you there."
"I'd like to fly with you," says the princess.
Admiral Rimba nearly spits out his mint.
"Your father would disapprove."
"I'm headed for the warfront regardless."
Jenny strokes the falcon undeterred. I look closer at her hand and see she has dyed the moon phases on her fingers. The henna marks match the patterns on her feet.
"Can your falcon carry another rider?"
Tinley squints at her in distrust. "Char can handle you, but it's up to His Majesty." Jemmy squares off with Ashwin.
"You could use another Buddha."
Her tone lacks the confidence of her posture. It matters that Ashwin thinks enough of her to let her come along. "I would rather she not. We do not know what we will find in Vani. I cannot worry about protecting two royals. I have not performed a full test of my powers since the numbness has set in. My blue glowing fingers from last night have left me unsettled about what else has changed."
"We're losing time," Jemmy presses.
"You may accompany us,"
Ashwin says slowly, as though uncertain about his decision. Jemmy dips into a regal bow.
"Thank you, Your Majesty."
I cannot decide whether to hit Ashwin in the arm or pat his back. He finally understands that Jemmy has the right to make her own decisions, but I am impatient to find Devon. Having missed the meeting point, he would go to Vani, the next location where he is assured Ashwin and I will be. The princess had better not slow us down.
24. Devon. The explosions start just after dawn. Our unit is already packed and hiking the path along the river. Quakes from the army's assault on the city wall vibrate up from the ground. We all removed our disguises, leaving our scarlet uniform jackets and headscarves in the hut. When I woke, my fingertips were healed. I cannot figure out why my burns are gone while Opal's are still healing. But it is a mercy I have no time to question. I increase our pace uphill in the bare morning light. Natasha and Yatin keep pace with me. Opal lags some, but her pallor and posture have improved from yesterday. Her galer powers are returning, so she listens for rebels. The stone pathway ends at a low tunnel. The entrance to the mines lies in the shadow of the turquoise palace. I pause to light a lamp we took from the hut, and a chakram flies past me, nearly slicing my nose. The blade embeds itself in the wall. All of us reel around, and the path beneath our feet drags us backward on a rock slide. Our backs hit the wall. Bands of hard dirt shackle our arms and legs. The Buddha warlord strides down the steps to the river. Haston's deeply tan complexion is distinguished by patches of white hair at his temples. His gray eyes are hard as stones. Anjali accompanies her father, chakram in hand. Two more rebels in all black uniforms trail them.
"Captain Naik, you insult me."
Haston's voice is gravelly like pebbles roll in his gullet.
"Did you really think you could sneak past us?"
I slant a glance at Opal. "I had hoped."
"I'm sorry," she whispers. "My powers are returning slowly."
"A Buddha?"
Haston asks, tipping back on his heels.
"The demon Raja sent one of my own to spy on me."
"We aren't with the army," Natasha says. "We serve Prince Ashwin."
Haston trembles the ground beneath us.
"The demon Raja and the prince are the same. Both are out to destroy our world."
A warning echoes in my mind, and my old suspicions manifest. "We were told you wish to unite with the Empire." Haston manipulates the stones around just me, pressing me into the wall.
"I'll never ally with Tarek's heir or his kindred."
"Are they alive?"
I squeeze out.
"Concern yourself with your own inevitable death," Anjali drawls.
Haston releases us from our dirt confines. Opal falls forward onto her knees,
residual grime in her bloodletting scars. Natasha helps her up.
Take them to the wives' wing,
Hostin tells his daughter, and then points menacingly at Opal.
Don't cause any trouble, or I'll throw you in the dungeons.
The palace dungeons are laced with poisons that dampen Buta powers. Hostin's reluctance to strip a fellow Buta of her defenses is a courtesy he does not offer us mortals. His soldiers disarm the rest of us. The warlord marches up to the palace. He must be holding us hostage for the same purpose he captured Tarek's Ronnies and courtesans. Leverage. Hostin hungers for the whole of the Empire, and he intends to manipulate Kali and Prince Ashwin, or entrap them, into getting what he desires. We are alive so long as they are, which is comforting in a sense. If Kali and the prince were dead, we would be too. Anjali yanks her chakram from the wall and pushes the rounded blade so close I can see my reflection in it.
Misbehave, and you'll lose your nose.
Yatin puffs out his chest, an instinctual reaction to protect me. Anjali's blade comes even closer. My breath fogs the steel.
Keep your troops in line, Captain.
She and her comrades herd us up the stairway to the palace wall. This section has no gate, yet one of Anjali's men opens a passageway in the clay bricks with his powers. We pass through the temporary door into the palace grounds, and the trembler closes it behind us. The rebels prod us down a pathway through the garden. The untended flower beds are overrun with weeds. Palm trees molt dead fronds, and the topiaries need a trim. But the grounds are still verdant and smell of sweet citrus and flowers. We enter the palace through a side door. Familiar jewel-toned draperies sweep across terrace doorways. Cool marble-tiled floors, white with rivers of nickel, echo our footsteps. Aromatic scents waft in from the high-arched open corridors. Desert sand, budding neem trees, and coconut oil. The corridors that once bustled with servants, court officials, and guards are lonely. Only a flamboyant peacock struts down the hall, dragging its brilliant tail feathers behind as it searches for sand fleas to dine on. Silence pours out of the courtesan's main entertaining hall. No music plays, or jade glass bottles clink. No hint of hookah smoke hazes the entry, or scent of women's perfume lingers. The absence of life startles me. Natasha slows and then quickens her gait away from the deserted wing. Her servitude as one of Raja Tarek's courtesans is a time she would rather forget. The doors to Tarek's chamber and atrium have been torn off. Within his private quarters, furniture and cushions lie about haphazardly, as though swept up by the wind and dumped in a jumble. Glass shards sparkle like frozen teardrops across the tile floor. Torn draperies hang lopsided, and piles of sand gather in the corners. The destruction of the Raja's quarters makes Hostin's rule more tangible. We are guided to the top floor of the wives' wing. Arched casements open to a view over the garden, palace wall, and forsaken city. Past them, dunes ripple into the horizon. Streaks of red. Soldiers in their uniforms swarm the main city gate and launch boulders from catapults. A gut-shaking boom resounds in the distance. The army will break in, I say, mostly to myself. It's inevitable.
They'll enter the city only when we are ready.
Anjali's cryptic reply tests my assumption that the rebels pulled back to protect the palace. How? I ask. She scoffs.
Think, Captain. What's the city wall made of?
All at once their strategy becomes clear. Clay bricks.
And where does clay come from?
She is patronizing me, but I answer all the same. The land.
My father stationed tremblers around the city to uphold the wall. As I said, your army won't enter unless we allow them.
As I said, we aren't with the army.
If my father suspected you were, you'd be dead. Anjali stops at the doorway to the Tigris Pavilion. Hold your breath.
What?
A wind barrels at us, smacking my breath away and pushing a